You are listening to the Horse Radio Network, part of the Equine Network family.
Welcome to this episode of the Disease du Jour podcast. I'm your host, Carly Sisson, and in this episode, I spoke with Dr. Sarah Eaton about the AAEP's new field diagnostic guidelines for equine infectious abortion. This episode of Disease du Jour is brought to you by Bimeda. Dr. Eaton is an associate professor of practice faculty at the University of Arizona's College of Veterinary Medicine. She graduated from the Purdue University College of Veterinary Medicine in 2006 with a focus on equine practice. After completing veterinary school, she completed a one-year internship in general equine practice and theriogenology at Durango Veterinary Clinic in Arizona. After her training, Dr. Eaton completed a theriogenology residency at the Western College of Veterinary Medicine under the guidance of Dr. Claire Card. She became a diplomat of the American College of Theriogenologists in 2009. After her residency, Dr. Eaton practiced in a mixed animal practice in British Columbia, an equine racetrack practice in New York, and a primary referral practice in Michigan. In 2021, she left private practice to join the University of Arizona College of Veterinary Medicine faculty. Dr. Eaton became a diplomat of the American Board of Veterinary Practitioners, Equine, in 2021. She is currently a member of the AVMA, AAEP, ABVP, SFT, and ACT. In addition to her teaching duties, Dr. Eaton serves on the Diversity, Equity, Inclusion, and Infectious Disease Committees of the AAEP, chairs the Outreach Committee for the ABVP, and is the faculty advisor for the University of Arizona CVM Integrative Medicine and Sports Medicine Student Club. Within the CVM, Dr. Eaton teaches equine clinical skills, theriogenology for all species, and portions of multiple large animal courses focusing on horses. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Eaton.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. To get us started, can you just explain what prompted the development of the AAEP's new infectious abortion field guidelines?
So I would love to give credit, and I think credit is definitely due to the AAEP Infectious Disease Committee, who really came up with the idea of having field diagnostic guidelines for various disease presentations. So they have already created the respiratory, the neuro, and the diarrhea ones. And so abortion was kind of the next step that made sense in the looking at the diseases that are prevalent in the equine industry and that can have huge herd-wide effects. I would say Dr. Toby Pinn-Woodcock out of Cornell was really one of the masterminds behind this and really got this moving and collaborated with a lot of people to get experts in the field on the various topics.
Yeah, they're really great resources, and I think it's such a great contribution to the industry that we have these available. So I'm excited to go through this a little bit more with you. From your perspective, what are the most important infectious and non-infectious causes of abortion that veterinarians should keep at the top of mind when they're approaching these cases?
I will say that while the topic or the article is titled Infectious Abortion Field Diagnostic Guidelines, we don't always know when they're infectious or not. So we chose to include non-infectious causes in there so that practitioners would have a good overview of what they were looking at in the field. So for non-infectious causes, it does vary a little bit on stage of gestation, but the big factors we're going to see are twins. That has become much less common as people have become more proficient with the ultrasound and owners are more aware of the need to evaluate mares at 14 to 16 days of gestation and reduce one twin. Cord torsion is another one that happens in later gestation and can be really frustrating and sometimes difficult to identify. At times, it's a diagnosis of exclusion. You've excluded all the other things, and this cord looks a little weird, so we're going to determine that that was the cause. And then fescue toxicosis can be another cause of abortion. That one usually is much later in the term, can actually lead to stillbirths or red bags, but it is something, again, that we see in various parts of the country that have high fescue levels. On the infectious side of things, we have mainly, you know, bacterial and viral agents that can cause it. Within the bacterial category, our two big ones are Streptococcus equi subspecies Zoepidemicus, and then E. coli. And these are ones that are present in the environment. Mares tend to get what's called ascending placentitis. So it goes up through the cervix and causes infection leading to abortion. From the viral side of things, the big one that we're concerned about and concerned about with other disease processes as well is equine herpes virus. So one in four can cause abortion. They're slightly different in the patterns of the outbreaks, but they are definitely concerning from a herd-wide standpoint and can be really devastating to producers. No, cardioform placentitis, it's kind of its own special little category that causes a hematogenous placentitis, but it is something to be concerned in certain parts of the country, specifically in Kentucky.
Thank you for the overview. The guidelines state that infectious causes should always be considered in every abortion until proven otherwise. Can you explain why that's so important?
This is really important because a lot of our broodmare farms are managed as a herd situation. So while we do definitely have owners and producers that are going to have 1 to 2 foals a year, we also have the other end of the spectrum where we have owners and producers that are producing 50, 80, 100 foals per year. And so we can see these outbreaks, what we call them abortion storms, where it just goes through the entire herd and can really reduce the number of foals that are present each year. Some of the listeners may remember the mare reproductive loss syndrome and the dramatic effects that it had on the equine industry in Kentucky for those few years. The reason we assume everything is contagious until proven otherwise is that it can be very difficult on initial presentation to determine whether something is contagious or not. And you'd hate for that first abortion to be deemed non-contagious and then find out that no, it's actually due to a contagious organism or an infectious organism when you have abortion 2, 3, 10, or 15. So when we're first presented with these clinically, we assume the worst and then do a lot of diagnostic testing to hopefully rule out all those horrible causes. And kind of the goal is that it's something non-infectious that we can, you know, either regret that it happened because it was something uncorrectable or plan for the future to manage the herd a little bit differently and reduce the non-infectious causes of abortion as well.
Right. We're going to get into biosecurity a little bit more later in this episode. But first, I'd love to go through the diagnostic flowchart that is included in the guidelines. Can you walk us through how you envision veterinarians using that tool during abortion investigations?
So we created this flowchart to really try and provide a visual and a clear-cut representation to veterinarians about what they need to collect when. So when we were working on it, we kind of thought about those vets that see maybe 1 to 2 abortions a year. It's not the main part of their practice, and they need someone to walk them through it step by step. So it goes through and discusses what you're going to see on your necropsy for certain various diseases based on their stage of gestation, as well as what you would want to collect for certain pathogens. In some cases, you have the ability to send off the fetus, the placenta, the dam's blood, and let the pathologist figure everything out. In other situations, you, the veterinarian, are responsible for collecting those samples. So this flowchart lays out exactly what samples you need to collect, how to package them so that they are more available, and then kind of what you would expect in terms of what stages of gestation.
This podcast is brought to you by Bimeda, the manufacturer of GastroBim. GastroBim, omeprazole, is the first and only FDA-approved bioequivalent to GastroGuard. Give your horse a scientifically proven, apple-flavored solution for gastric ulcers. Because equine gastric ulcer syndrome is complex, always work with your veterinarian for proper diagnosis and care. Same trusted treatment, less cost. That's GastroBim. The safety of GastroBim paste has not been determined in pregnant or lactating mares. For use in horses and foals 4 weeks of age and older. So what does the typical diagnostic approach look like from taking your history to examining the mare and the placenta and the fetus?
The approach to managing an outbreak or an abortion is also discussed in the diagnostic guidelines. So it takes you through the steps, and we tried to put them in order of what we would recommend doing them. So starting out with your history, and history can be really important in some of these outbreak cases because we need to know where were these mares, where are they now, did they travel, did other horses come into contact with them, what is their vaccination history. And that can be quite different for some broodmares, whether they're bred with AI, where the mare doesn't go anywhere and the semen comes in, or if they're bred live cover and are going on and off the farm, possibly bringing things back with them. After we get our history, then we do recommend doing the examination of the mare. And the reason behind that is we're trying to go from hopefully the least infected thing to the most infected thing. So the examination of the mare starts with a general physical examination. We want to see if she has any signs of systemic illness. But then there are also some things that we look at specifically. The external reproductive tract. You may also want to do an internal reproductive tract exam, a vaginal examination, evaluation of the mammary glands, and then evaluation of the abdominal wall itself. And the guidelines do walk you through what you're looking for in each of those areas. Once you've completed the exam of the mare, then we do like to do either the exam of the placenta or the fetus, ideally both if possible. But it's important to remember when you have an abortion that the placenta can be a really good source of information, you know, so it's training those clients that when a mare aborts, we need to keep that placenta so that we can look at it and see what's going on. So you want to evaluate the placenta in its entirety as much as you can. I usually train my clients to put it into a plastic bag or a bucket or a bag inside of a bucket, some way to keep it away from dogs, other people, you know, not throwing it in the trash. I have had some clients, for example, here in Arizona, I'll have them put it in the refrigerator because it can be 100 degrees and nobody likes to see a hot, stinky placenta sitting out in the sun. But then the placenta is evaluated both on its weight. So it should weigh approximately 10% of the foal's weight in a normal placenta. Its appearance, are there any areas that have different coloration, discoloration, mucus, anything else attached to it? And then we look at both sides of the placenta. So the maternal interfacing side and the fetal facing side to see if there's any discrepancies in that. You then want to take samples from various points, and that is laid out as well in the diagnostic guidelines. We've got a little diagram that was made that really explains what parts we're talking about when we say to sample different parts and where you want to collect them from. And if the placenta is still attached to the fetus, then obviously you can work your way up the umbilical cord to the fetus. If not, we end by looking at the fetus, both externally in terms of evaluating the size, the weight, any external changes that you might notice that are present, and then going internally and collecting samples from, for example, the liver, the stomach contents, the lungs, things like that, and then packaging that all up so that you can send it off and find out what's going on.
Do you have any tips, or do the guidelines have any tips for sample handling and storage when you're going through this process?
Yes, we do. We have a whole section on diagnostic testing, which tells you what samples to collect, including what tubes to put them in, because sometimes you're not sure, is it red, is it purple? When in doubt, I usually err and get both of them just to err on the side of caution. But then also how to collect the samples, what can be stored together, what should be stored separately, and how to package it. So obviously your preserved samples in formalin are not going to be temperature sensitive, but the fresh samples that we are sometimes submitting for bacterial or viral sampling, you're going to want to keep them cool. So either on ice or in a cooler, but we don't want to freeze them because that can also affect some of your histological findings. So we lay out how to package everything up. And one of the special things that we recommend on the equine abortion side, in addition to the placenta, is the fetal stomach contents, because those fetuses are drinking in all that fluid while they're in utero and can provide some really useful diagnostic information.
Yeah, that's a great tip. And I should have mentioned this before, but of course, these guidelines will be linked in the show notes for anyone to check out in more detail. So as you're going through your diagnostics, are there any particular findings that would immediately raise concern for a specific infectious cause of abortion?
So as I work through how to, you know, working up this abortion, a lot of my, you know, concerns are pinged based on the history. So if the mare has not traveled, then certain things go much lower on the list. If she goes back and forth, say to a training barn, or has young horses coming back and forth, then something viral would be much higher on the list. So I do a lot of history taking from the owner, asking really detailed questions about, you know, who lives next to who horse-wise, and if they're seeing any other clinical signs. Also, when I look at the placenta, that can be really useful for evaluating for ascending placentitis. So if we lay out the placenta in the classical F shape or ram's horn shape, depending on kind of who taught you your theorio, you can see that the portion that's closest to the cervix in cases of ascending placentitis often has almost a line of demarcation of normal placenta and infected placenta. So that can kind of trigger you to think about something bacterial. And then some of our viral infections, such as our herpes infections, cause these classic pinpoint cream or gray colored spots in the liver. So when I open up a fetus and I see those pinpoint spots on the liver, while it's not pathognomonic, it just kind of directs me to go in that direction for something like herpes virus abortion.
Now, what happens if you go through all of your diagnostics and the results are inconclusive? What should the veterinarian's next step be?
So I realize this can be really frustrating. You know, I think there are published papers out there, you know, giving ranges of successful identification of causes of abortion from anywhere from 30 to 60%, which means that we're unsuccessful, you know, in anywhere from 50 to 70% of the time. And that's going to vary a lot depending on where you are, what the horse does for travel, things like that. And so I would recommend that when you're starting this out, before you even start the necropsy and collecting your samples, that you have a discussion with the owner that we may find nothing, but that is actually good news because it tells us it's not something abortion or something infectious that we need to worry about. So I try to preface it with we want to find nothing, because if we find something, then we have to try to stop it from going through the rest of the herd, depending on if it's something infectious or not. I would also recommend people who aren't comfortable doing a lot of these, if they do get a negative finding, to reach out either to their local diagnostic lab, their local vet school, even their local theogenologist. Most of us are pretty happy to answer the phone and talk about stuff and just discuss what the findings that they do find might mean to help them, again, convey that information back to the owner and really create a treatment plan or a management plan going forward. So this is something that, you know, if we had an abortion this year, the owner and I are going to be talking about what are we going to do for next year to hopefully prevent this from happening again, or heaven forbid, prevent it from spreading throughout the herd.
Yeah, that's great advice. What are some of the infectious abortion prevention and biosecurity strategies that the guidelines highlight?
So we do talk quite a bit about assuming everything is infectious until proven otherwise, and that is intentional. It started very early in the document and stated multiple times, because as I said earlier, we don't always know if it's infectious or not until we do the diagnostic testing. So that is highlighted, and one should really practice strong biosecurity when you're working up an abortion to reduce the risk of transmitting it to other animals on the farm. We also try to focus on doing full diagnostics whenever possible. I know sometimes we'll fall down that rabbit hole of saying, I just need to rule out if it's, say, herpes or not, or I need to identify that it's this or not that. And it's important to think about, you know, collecting as many samples as you can. You don't necessarily have to, do testing on all of them right away, but you've got them, because once the remains have been disposed of, you don't have access to go back to those samples. So collecting as many samples as you can, and then ideally doing a full necropsy and full diagnostic testing, but if not, keeping them for potential future diagnostic testing. We also talk about monitoring the other mares in the herd. So some of these abortions tend to seem to be out of nowhere, and that is definitely possible. But then when you start asking these histories of owners, a lot of times they will say, well, yeah, there was a run through of snotty noses, you know, 2 or 3 weeks ago, or I did have another mare bag up a week or so ago. Maybe we should check her. So really finding out as much history as you can about the horses that may seem completely unrelated, and it may be completely unrelated, but you won't know until you start asking those questions. And then finally, the role and the importance of vaccination and husbandry in preventing some of these abortion storms. So we do mention that there are, you know, practice good biosecurity even before the abortion occurs, and then ensure once you've got either an abortion happening or has happened in the past, that you're providing adequate vaccination for those mares. So that may not be during that breeding season, but it may be something that going forward, we're going to enact additional vaccination protocols so that they're protected either before breeding or throughout their pregnancy.
Yeah, and I imagine that biosecurity is going to expand to neighboring areas if your history collection reveals that the mare maybe traveled to a stud farm or traveled off the property. There might be some communication involved with your local area.
There is, to some extent. I mean, it's a little bit we care what comes in, and it's not that we don't care what goes out, but it doesn't kind of matter to you as much unless you're shipping your pregnant mare from one group of pregnant mares to another group of pregnant mares, then she could act as a fomite and carry something through. It's pretty amazing. Some of these farms that have a lot of different age groups going, you know, you'll start asking the questions and somebody will say, oh yeah, we had, you know, the yearlings had a run through of runny noses, but they all seem fine. Nobody had a fever. And now we're seeing abortions in the mare herd. And so we really have to talk about how things cross from different age groups, different health statuses, you know, pregnant to non-pregnant mares, because owners just aren't aware of it until there's a problem.
Yeah, it's a great point. Is there anything else that you'd like to highlight from the guidelines before we wrap up today?
I think, you know, if anyone's dealing with any chance of pregnant mares, it really would be beneficial for them to at least familiarize themselves with the documents. They're pretty short. You know, one is a single page document, one is a 4-page document. You can download it onto your phone pretty easily and have it available so that if you are out, you know, in the middle of the night or on a Sunday afternoon and dealing with an abortion or, heaven forbid, an abortion storm, you've got that background of information to at least get you started and know what samples to collect so that you can talk to whatever specialist you need to once kind of we get back into business hours.
Yeah. And again, I will have the guidelines linked in the show notes below so you can easily access them and take them with you. Thank you so much again, Dr. Eaton, for joining us on the podcast and talking us through these guidelines with a little bit more detail.
Excellent. Well, thank you for having me, and I really appreciate your group being interested in them.
I would like to say thank you again to Dr. Eaton for joining us, and thank you to Bimeda for supporting this episode. And as always, thank you to our listeners for tuning in to Disease Du Jour. If you have any questions or suggestions for the podcast, please email me at csisson@equinenetwork.com.